Registration is now open on What's-Her-Name's Yucatan Tour 2024. Join us in Mexico as we walk in the footsteps of Zazzle Ha, learn traditional Mayan cooking, tour Mayan ruins, snorkel with sea turtles, and so many more off-the-beaten-track adventures with our wonderful little band of kindred spirits. Spots are going fast, so sign up now on our website at whatshernamepodcast.com. We can't wait to see you there. Support for this episode is provided by our Patreon supporters, Julie Gray, Bree Smith, Robin Brown, Janelise Cannon, Jamie Lang, Maria Carla Sanchez, Valerie Jacobson, Jill Harrigan, Heather McKinnon, Chantel Oliver, Lindsay Cummings, and Catherine Vogel. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Olivia.
If you knew that you probably only had months or years to live, what would you do?
I don't know. I ask myself this a lot. And sometimes I'm like, I would just keep doing what I'm doing.
I think it's a question that, you know, we ask a lot as sort of either a weird conversation starter or sort of for personal.
Like social media is asking you this all the time, you know, like, how are you going to live your best life?
Yeah.
I think I would not do anything I don't like doing. Like, I don't know, like maintaining the plumbing and.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd probably see those last few places that I really want to see in the world and haven't been to yet.
Yeah, for me, I think it would be some combination of maximizing time spent with the people that I love and doing the things that I really want to do before I die, you know, seeing those last few places, and then preparing the people that I love for my death, right? Like, leave letters or...
Yeah. I don't think there's any one right way to do it.
Okay. I'm interested to see if your answer shifts if I ask the question this way.
Okay.
What if you knew that your whole family had months or years to live? That everyone important to you, all the people you love around you, have months or years to live?
Well...
Does that change anything? How do you spend your remaining time now?
Wow, for some reason it makes it way less high stakes and way less like your own personal responsibility.
Yeah, if I don't have to think about how my death will affect the people around me.
If we're all gonna die. Yeah.
If you have nothing to lose,
I would say make it a party. Eat, drink, and be merry, man. Go through everybody's bucket list together.
Well, the woman we're talking about today had to face those questions in the most literal way. And the way that she answered them is unbelievable.
Huh!
Literally unbelievable, as in, I did not believe it.
Wow!
And many of the people who heard it did not believe it for years.
Fascinating.
Dr. Janina Mehlberg, mathematician, philosopher, resistance worker, spy, humanitarian aid worker, activist, social worker, professor, unstoppable force, faced that question and decided that if she was definitely going to die, then she was going to do as much good as she possibly could in the time she had left. Without fear. When the fear of death is gone.
Wonderful.
Because it's inevitable. You can take what I think most people would categorize as absolutely insane risks.
I love it. I already changed my answer. Take me and my family and do as much good as possible. Love it.
Yes. As now I feel bad, right?
Yep. Like, oh, party. That's, yep.
I think
you could combine the two.
Some combination of do the fun stuff I've always wanted and try to figure out how to leave the world a better place than it was. I certainly would not have been able to do what she did. I'm Olivia Mickle.
And I'm Katie Nelson.
And this is What's Her Name?
fascinating women you've never heard of.
When I first heard this story last year, I heard sort of the bare bones highlights of this woman's life, and my first response was, that can't be true. That's ridiculous. That could not have happened. And that is, to be fair, a lot of people's responses, including one of the authors of the new book, The Counterfeit Countess. Elizabeth White first heard this story in 1989.
I'm Barry White, Dr. Elizabeth B. White. I'm a professional historian, recently retired from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. I worked at the museum for a decade, and then before that, I spent 30 years at the United States Department of Justice, helping with investigations and prosecutions of Nazi criminals and other human rights violators living in the United States. This goes all the way back to 1989, when I gave a conference paper on Majdanek concentration camp, which was located in German-occupied Lublin, Poland, during World War II. After the panel, the historian I didn't know handed me a carbon copy manuscript. He said it was the memoir of Janina Mailberg, Polish-Jewish mathematician, who had helped prisoners at Majdanek while pretending to be a Polish Christian aristocrat. He explained that Mailberg had died in 1969, and so he had decided to donate it to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, but he really wanted me to take this copy because I was writing about Majdanek, and so he hoped that I could make this incredible story now. The thing is, I read this story, and it really is incredible. She claimed that she survived the Holocaust in German-occupied Poland using the false identity of the Countess Sukadolska. And she became an official of a Polish relief organization where her job included negotiating face-to-face with Nazi and SS officials in Lublin, Poland, which was the headquarters of the largest murder operation of the Holocaust. Focus of her work was at Majdanek, where she ran a program to provide food and supplies for thousands of prisoners there. And she brought these herself into the camp, knowing that this was a place where Jews were being murdered in gas chambers and shooting pits. And more than that, she used her deliveries as cover to smuggle messages and supplies to members of the resistance imprisoned in the camp.
Because she was also an officer in the underground Polish Home Army. No, right? No, of course not. That's nonsense.
Given what I knew about Majdanek and Lublin and what was happening there during the war, this claim that she, as a Jewish woman, had dared to enter Majdanek, a place of mass murder, almost daily, and had smuggled supplies to the resistance under the noses of the SS seemed almost too fantastic to me to be true. So there was no way I could use this without first confirming. And I couldn't do that at the time. One big impediment for me is that I don't know Polish. So I kept thinking that another historian would come across the memoir in the archives and do what was necessary to bring it to light.
But nobody did. And over the years, it haunted her.
So finally, I started digging into this more when I was working at the Holocaust Museum. And that's when I ended up getting in touch with Joanna. I only knew by reputation as an expert on the Holocaust in Poland. She, as soon as she read the memoir, was all in on partnering with me.
Hello, my name is Dr. Joanna Sliwa. I am a Holocaust historian by training. I work as historian at the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany, where I also manage academic programs. And before joining the Claims Conference, I worked at Jewish nonprofits, including at the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee and at the Museum of Jewish Heritage, a living memorial to the Holocaust. So when Barry reached out to me in 2018, we were connected actually through my former doctoral advisor, Dr. Deborah Dwork. And Bora told me, you know, there's this historian at the Holocaust Museum working on this project about this countess. Would you be interested? And of course, I kind of like jumped, like, wow, that is such an amazing story. I've never heard anything like this. And I would be curious to know more. Can we really find evidence that this story was in fact true, that the Countess Suchodolska was in fact a Polish-Jewish woman?
And very quickly, she found the definitive proof.
And Barry and I immediately started working on this project, doing more research to learn more about Janina's activities, initiatives within the Main Welfare Council. That was the relief organization for which she worked during World War II. And of course, we found a lot of documents in the Polish archives. And we discovered much more than what Janina wrote in her memoir, which also told us that she was even more remarkable than her memoir tells.
That a Jewish mathematician could keep up this elaborate ruse, do all of this deep cover infiltrating of the Nazi machine, convince not only the enemy, but her own friends and colleagues, members of the resistance, that she was a Polish countess, and that she could keep this secret not only during the war, but after the war, and lives her entire life without ever breathing a word of this until 2 decades later. That's absurd. It's impossible. It simply cannot be true. But it is. And Barry White and Joanna Sliva proved it.
Cool.
More than that, they illuminated her life. They found so much more context and information and depth to add to the story that Janina herself had told. And they put it all into an absolutely astonishing new book, The Counterfeit Countess, the Jewish Woman Who Rescued Thousands of Poles During the Holocaust.
Amazing!
Because Janina didn't tell everything in this memoir. She leaves out 34 years of her life before World War II and all of her life after, but also she didn't know everything that was going on. She couldn't know the extent of the impact of some of her actions at the time.
Mm.
She couldn't know what was happening behind the scenes of what she was doing and how things happened.
There are just so many really riveting, vivid scenes in her memoir. You know, it really lets us tell a lot of the story from her perspective, incorporating her thoughts.
Together, Elizabeth White and Joanna Sliwa and Janina Mellberg have created something amazing. Janina Mellberg was born Peppy Spinner.
Cute.
On May 1st, 1905. Adorable. Her childhood was very unusual. Her parents were wealthy. They owned an estate in the countryside in eastern Galicia. And she was raised one step away from aristocracy. Literally, the next door neighbors are all Polish nobles. They went to the same parties. They socialized with their families. She was taught by the same governesses and nannies and tutors. She was raised to fit in the peak genteel elite circles of Polish society. She was fluent in Polish, German, and French, and pretty good in English, Russian, and Ukrainian. Probably also some Yiddish too, because she was Jewish. And that didn't matter very much until it did. In World War I, the Russian army confiscates all property owned by Jews, and as they are driven out again by the Central Powers about a year later, they kidnapped and eventually killed her father.
Oof.
Anti-Semitism skyrockets, and being Jewish suddenly matters a lot in her life in ways that it never had before.
Mm-hmm.
Yanina was brilliant. She was a star student studying math under two famous mathematicians. And she became incredibly fascinated with Hugo Steinhaus's probability theory and mathematical reasoning. She got the equivalent of a master's degree. But girls were not allowed in the PhD program in mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
Girls could do a PhD in philosophy at the famed Warsaw Lvov School.
The Warsaw Lvov School was created by Professor Kazimierz Twardowski, and both Yanina and future husband were part of this circle. And this was a very influential circle. And one of the things that the professor highlighted was that philosophy is not only about acquiring knowledge, but it's also a moral stance. And he tried to instill that in his students.
He had no problem with women. And she found a way to combine mathematics and philosophy.
Her dissertation was on mathematical reasoning and traditional logic. And she argued that mathematical reasoning can't rely on traditional logic, but has to draw from other areas of thought, including imagination and intuition.
Oh, interesting.
And that if you are calculating probabilities, you have to include all of those things to understand the actual probabilities of any given situation. Now, this seemingly very esoteric field of study is going to become vitally important for her success and her survival in the coming years. While in that PhD program, she meets her husband. Henry Melberg was impressed and drawn to this unusual woman. Charming, lively, sophisticated, fiercely intelligent, and unwilling to back down in any debate or argument. Henry tended to dominate conversations and debates, much to the dismay of his male colleagues. But Yanina also refused to be dominated and held her own spectacularly well. And she did so with a good humor and a calm and charm to the point where he almost enjoyed finding out that he was wrong and she was right, which happened a lot. They get married, they get teaching positions back in Lvov, and settle into a happy and comfortable life as academics. But things in Lvov were not the same. Economic depression, political polarization, nationalism, xenophobia, huge debates about who counts as a real Polish citizen, who belongs in Poland. There's an authoritarian coup. There's more pogroms, there's increasing discrimination and segregation against Jews. And there are increasing threats from Nazi Germany that seems pretty determined to take over Poland. Nobody believed that Germany would be stupid enough to antagonize all three of its main rivals, England, France, and Russia, which had all promised to defend Poland if Hitler was stupid enough to try anything. Spoilers, he was. He did. And they didn't. Russia had made a secret deal with Germany, and by the end of 1939, Poland was occupied territory. Things escalate and escalate and escalate. We know this story. Jews are forced to wear armbands, they're being forced into ghettos. They are being disappeared. And eventually, the Melbergs realize they have to get out of Lvov if they possibly can, but they have no idea where to go. They eventually decide to join Henry's family in Kopiecince, where there were not yet any ghettos, and it seemed the best chance for survival. Henry's family sends a carriage. It is on its way to pick them up. They hear a knock at the door. Yanina's family's old friend, Count Andrei Kaczynski. And he tells them that he has come to get them. He wants them to come with him to Lublin, where he could get them false papers, a place to live, and jobs.
Wow.
But that means they have to travel with him, not as Jews, as fellow aristocrats in these identities he has made up for them. They don't have papers, and they will be shot if they are caught traveling without their armband. But Kaczynski assures them he can get them out and he can keep them safe. And they decide to do it.
Whew.
Instead of joining Henry's family, they calculate the odds and they join Kaczynski on a desperate leap.
Wow.
Toward a slightly higher probability of survival. They almost get caught several times. At one point, Henry is being taken and Yanina gets right in the guard's face. What are you doing? Don't you know who we are? And astonishingly, it works.
Class trumps everything.
Pepi Melberg leaves Lvov and arrives in Lublin, Countess Yanina Sukodolska. Unaware that Lublin is about to become the staging ground for Axion Reinhardt, the original comprehensive plan to deal with undesirables in Germany. This is the birthplace of the Holocaust. This is where it was planned, where it was experimented with, organized, laid out. The camps of Axion Reinhardt are by far the deadliest of all of the camps in the Holocaust. And the Jews of Lublin are being disappeared at an astonishing rate. Continual clouds of smoke from the crematoriums at the concentration camp Majdanek. Originally, it's a POW camp, but it very quickly becomes used for lots more than that.
Something that kind of surprised us when we were first shopping our book, our agent and our publishers we talked to had no idea that the Germans considered the Poles to be subhuman racial enemies and that they persecuted them horribly and that the Nazis planned to wipe out 80 to 85% of the Poles. So that is a very important context for our book.
The Holocaust was not just about Jews. Obviously, that's in the end the main target. But the Holocaust started with the disabled, with trans people, with Roma people, other ethnic groups that they believed to be subhuman. The first acts of mass murder are to wipe out entire children's hospitals full of disabled children.
The Germans invented the gas chambers in order to murder Germans because they were mentally or physically disabled. Even before the Final Solution began, the Germans already murdered at least 70,000 Germans who were disabled. It was very important for us to use Yanina's story to explain the larger context of the Holocaust, the Final Solution, and the persecution of the Poles, which were connected because they were all part of an overall Nazi plan to impose a racist new order in Europe. And so those plans called, yes, the immediate extermination of the Jews because there were not to be any Jews in this new Europe, anywhere where Germans lived. But it also called for the mass murder and even genocide of other groups.
Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Poles and 2 million Soviet POWs. So that's even before they got around to murdering Jews for being Jews.
Yanina cannot stand by and watch this happen. She has been given sort of a free pass for safety, they think at the beginning. She has a job, she has a new identity. They could just hide and try to get through. But she cannot do that. She has to help.
Yanina wanted to join the Polish underground. She wanted to be more involved in the Polish main welfare council. And of course, Count Andrzej Skrzyński couldn't do everything himself running the organization in the Lublin district. And he understood that Yanina would be perfect for as his assistant.
And she quickly joins the Polish underground. and then joins the Polish Aid Committee, known as the RGO, and begins doing really important work aiding Polish displaced people, Polish prisoners, these other victims of the Nazis' actions.
She would go to these great lengths to keep on pushing.
But things are getting increasingly worse. It becomes really clear. They're just killing all the Jews. They're going to kill all the Jews.
There's a turning point in the book where they're in Lublin, they have their false identities, but she realizes that even as Poles, they still face persecution and death. And she realizes that the odds are not good for her surviving the war. And so she decides she wanted to make whatever was left of her life meaningful.
They're not going to survive this war. And so if they're not going to survive, the calculations change.
Mm.
And if I'm going to die, I can put survival as a goal out of my mind.
Yeah.
I can work strictly with the probabilities of the next mission, the next goal, the next project. Her motto was very simple.
She governed her actions based on a simple mathematical principle. One life has a lesser value than multiple lives, and her own life would have no value if she only used it to save herself.
Wow. It's a mathematical, logical calculation.
She does the math. And if the probability of success was good enough,
yeah,
it is worth the risk. And she does it.
That's awesome.
And she goes to work. She has never done anything like this before.
She turned out to be a masterful organizer. She was organizing all of these big initiatives and finding the money and keeping track of everything, and then went on and continued to do that work on a national level after the war. So finding all of these new talents and capabilities in the face of war and danger. Some of her first acts of bravery are to save Henry, her husband, and that's where she starts to learn that she has this capacity to kind of stare people down, German officials and soldiers.
And learning these things about herself, her goals become, most people would say, totally insane, ridiculous, impossible. She is not just providing food for the people who've been displaced, for the sick children in Poland. She decides she needs to provide for the prisoners in Majdanek concentration camp.
Dang.
She knows she will not be allowed to do anything for the Jewish prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many other people in these camps who are not there for any infraction or punishment. They're only there because the Nazis wanted their lands to give to German settlers. As part of this goal of the Germanification of Europe, they kick out hundreds of thousands of Poles and move in German settlers. Some of the Poles are moved to other areas. The rest are shoved into camps. They're not particularly trying to kill them, but they're not particularly invested in keeping them alive. Disease is rife, starvation. It's a concentration camp. And while they are wholesale murdering Jews, they are still killing anyone who gets sick, anyone too sick to work, anyone with a contagious disease, anyone who makes themselves inconvenient is not going to last long at Majdanek. Janina spends months advocating with every Nazi official she can find access to, charming them, rationalizing to them, explaining to them why they should allow the RGO to provide soup, bread, medications, vaccinations, mail. Let us take this burden off your hands. Under the civil government of Poland, it is our job to aid Polish prisoners. And we could help you so you don't have to bother feeding them. They know they're not feeding them. But she frames it in terms of, look, let us help. let us vaccinate the prisoners for typhus. Your guards might catch typhus. You might catch typhus. And we have all of these typhus vaccinations.
She kept pushing and pushing. And whenever she just saw a hint that someone would be agreeable to something, she kept on pressing for more.
And she had a real knack for framing her requests, not as requests, but as measures that were so obviously in the interests of the German authorities that it would be silly for them to turn her down.
We have all of this food, and think of the money that you'll save. Let the prisoners send postcards to their families so they know they're here. So you won't be troubled with all of these people coming to bother you asking if their family is here.
And when one person said no, she would just keep going around to others and going over their heads until she found someone to say yes. And then when they told her yes, she considered it an invitation to ask for even more.
She changes tactics on a dime, depending on who she's talking to and what seems like it might work.
Huh.
Sometimes she's so sweet and unassuming and humble. Oh, I would be so grateful if you would allow us to do this. She's always polite, but she sometimes, when she has calculated the odds that this will be the most successful, she is the autocratic countess just sort of telling them what's going to happen. And although all of this class nonsense is supposed to be done away with in the Nazi regime, all of these people have been raised stewing in fear or respect or awe of the aristocracy.
The Germans considered the Poles to be subhuman racial enemies. German officials normally wouldn't give Poles a time of day, and they certainly didn't stand yet invite them to sit down. But somehow when this very composed and dignified countess waltzed into the office, that it was just almost automatic to stand.
Now I am standing, and I've shown this level of respect that I'm not supposed to, and now what do I do? Because I can't sit back down without looking stupid. I wasn't going to offer her a chair, but now I have to either offer her a chair or I have to stand the whole time, too.
Mm-hmm.
Walking into the room, she has already thrown them off their game, and they are already unsettled and don't know how to deal with her.
I can see how with certain characters she could play the role of like, I'm the wealthy countess. It's in my DNA to do charity, so let me do charity.
Yes, that's what aristocratic women do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Please just let me give to the peasants.
Yeah. And she's probably well connected because she's a countess. And she could make your life pretty difficult if you don't give her what she wants.
Mm-hmm.
She's annoying. She will not stop. And that's one thing that any Nazi official that deals with her learns really quick is that she will never leave you alone. She will be on your doorstep every day until you agree to what she wants. And it's just easier to give it to her because it's stupid anyway. Fine, if she wants to waste her time and the resources of the people feeding sick Poles, who cares?
Yeah.
Whatever. Fine.
Yeah.
She said once, if I ask for the finger, I'm coming for the whole hand. And when you allow her first to drop off soup for the sick prisoners at the front gate, within weeks, she's going to be helpfully explaining that it would be so much more convenient for her and her workers, and obviously for you, if you just let us into the camp to drop it off. You know, it would be easier if we just actually went into the infirmaries. And, you know, I really should talk to the doctors instead of having to bother you with all of that information. And she's also really good at understanding what motivates men in hierarchies, let's say.
She was very accustomed to navigating her way through a men's world and using some of their assumptions and prejudices to her advantage.
She gets a lot done by tattling on one official to another official for not obeying his orders. If this official gives her permission to do blank, and that official stops her, why are you ignoring the orders of the commandant?
Oh, yeah.
And going to the commandant and saying, he's not listening to what you said. He's being disrespectful to your authority.
Wow.
She's poking at those little petty rivalries of these petty tyrants.
Mm-hmm.
And it works amazingly well.
And she just had this intuitive insight into human personalities. She was always calculating the odds of her success of her actions and then weighing whether the risk was worth the potential reward.
And somehow she is now delivering 1,200 liters of soup 3 days a week in old milk cans, 15-gallon milk tins. And then they are returned and she brings them back. One day she scolds the Jewish doctor who is imprisoned and also serving as the doctor that he is really not doing a very good job of scrubbing out the bottom of these soup tins. He really needs to pay more attention to the bottoms, she says, under the eye of three SS guards.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have installed false bottoms in the soup tins. And now they are smuggling in letters, information, medicines, anything that needs to go in.
That's great.
Right under their noses. When she picks up the empty soup cans the next day, in the bottom of one of the cans is a note. God bless your committee. Please continue. We know that the Countess can do everything. We can too.
Oh.
And I think that for me is the most important thing that she understands. She smuggles in food and medicine and the necessaries. She understands that the most important thing she can smuggle in is hope. These people have no hope.
Mm-hmm.
And what this food from outside means, in addition to you might survive another day, is there are people outside the barbed wire.
Yeah. Working
who know
to
you are
help
here.
You. Yes.
Who care. Yes. You are not forgotten.
Yeah.
People are working outside on your behalf. And the people who later talk about the work that she did bring that up over and over again that that it was that knowledge that kept them alive.
Totally.
Knowing that someone cared, a countess cared enough to get thousands of people involved. Because let's think about the scale of this for a minute.
Of course, Janina could not have done everything by herself. There had to be an entire network, not only to enable her actions, but to support her in her actions and to take initiative on their own, which other women did. And as Barry and I were doing our research, we discovered this entire network of women who are part of either part of the resistance or may not necessarily have been part of the resistance, but who resisted on their own. They tried to find ways to establish contact with the prisoners in Majdanek. Women were active in that. Women were active in smuggling messages, in serving as couriers. Later on, when Janina received a request for, it was a pneumothorax, right? And an X-ray machine. How do you smuggle that into the camp?
And we think part of the reason she wrote her memoir was also to honor the people who worked with her, especially in the Polish Maid Welfare Council, because that organization was practically wiped from history by the communists, because it was an organization that was founded and in large part run by aristocrats. So it was really almost wiped from Polish history during the communist period.
Also in preparing food and kind of thinking about how do we package it? How do we smuggle it in? And where do we get this food from? Again, she didn't do this alone. She did it with other people.
Who's making all that food?
Yeah.
Everyone in Lublin, the nuns at the convent are providing thousands of liters of soup. The RGO is providing thousands of liters of soup upper-class women are spending all day peeling potatoes and chopping ingredients and are sending mail, sending packages. All of the local trucking companies are donating their trucks. The welders are making secret false bottoms to the milk cans. The whole city is involved in this effort.
Oh my gosh.
Anything they can to keep these people alive. Okay, but how did she get away with any of this? How is she successfully convincing all of these people that she's a countess? She's not a countess. She's a mathematician. But her upbringing, mingling with aristocrats, attending the same events, playing with their children.
Oh, yeah.
She doesn't just speak French. She speaks the right kind of French. She speaks fancy folk French. She knows exactly how a countess behaves.
If you have the mannerisms.
She's been preparing for this role her whole life.
Yeah, like all aristocrats in Europe had been playing that game for 50 years. With the new rising middle class, I had to come up with some way to differentiate. And so it became all about manners and all about how you act and like little micro expressions even. And if you can do that, then well.
Then no one's going to question it.
Yeah.
And so she could spin this reliable story on the spot saying she is Countess Janina Subodolska. Her husband was not in the same position. He also had this false identity of the count, but he was a Jewish man, which meant that he could be easily recognized as a Jew.
Jewish men are uniquely in danger of being identified. Which had not occurred to me.
Only Jewish men were circumcised. And that did happen.
You mean like forced inspections?
Yeah. In the streets, door-to-door searches, at national borders.
Wow.
German officers are demanding every man in this room pull down your pants.
Dang.
Women don't have a visible physical marker of Judaism to give them away. So while Henry has to stay pretty closely closeted at home to avoid these random inspections,
dang,
she can move freely. She's so brilliant at knowing exactly what to do in any case. Joanna Sliwa describes her as a charismatic chameleon.
Cool.
I think that just her charisma and her charm really allowed her to do what she did to get those Nazis and other German officials to do what she wanted them to do. And then just the chameleon part, she really was able to get into the roles that she kind of envisioned for herself. If that was the countess role, when she was, as Barry mentioned later on, you know, deputy director of the social welfare organization. She was never a social worker. And there you go. She was traveling around Poland, writing reports, talking with people, assessing the situation. She was traveling abroad. She went to Geneva. She went to the U.S. on a United Nations fellowship where she traveled around the U.S. to learn about childcare. So she was a chameleon there.
At one point, she's trying to convince the commandant that she should bring in extra soup. She goes in, proposes her plans, lays them all out. Obviously, the sick prisoners need more food, and we're happy to provide that. And the head of the camp is getting pretty tired of her and getting a little suspicious. Not that she's not a countess, but that she might be more than just a relief worker. Perhaps she is working with the underground. And he threatens her. One can always gain entrance here, but the exits may not be quite so obvious.
Ooh.
Could there be a clearer warning?
Ooh.
You are on thin ice here. Do not push this.
Huh.
But she pushes it.
And
she waits all day outside his office until finally he agrees to allow her to bring in extra soup on the off days.
I guess if you were confident in your countessness and you had nothing to fear, then you wouldn't be intimidated.
That's the thing I find the most remarkable. She is intimidated. She writes about being absolutely terrified all the time. She knows she is inches away from death. And when she leaves, she's shaking all the way home. But she does it anyway. Because one life is worth less than many lives.
Wow.
And she has to do it. On November 2nd, 1943, she visits the camp and delivers a massive amount of food. The next day, at her RGO office in Lublin, she begins to hear rumors of gunfire at the camps. Clouds of black smoke coming not from the crematoriums, but from the open fields.
Oof.
And she frantically runs to the camp to see if she can find out what's happening. She is brusquely turned away at the gate and asks if she can bring food tomorrow. And they tell her not to come because tomorrow there will be too much food for the prisoners anyway.
Ooh.
She doesn't know for sure what's happening. She is afraid that what seems to be happening is the total extermination of all of the prisoners in the camp.
Yeah.
She is desperate to find out what's going on. No one will tell her. Finally, 2 days later, the empty soup cans are put out on the road as normal, and she finds a letter smuggled in the bottom detailing what has happened. I will not go into details here because it is so horrific, but again, everyone needs to read the book. In 36 hours, 18,000 Jews were murdered at Majdanek.
Wow.
Every Jew at Majdanek and the surrounding camps and any Jews they could round up in the city are wholesale eliminated. This seems to come out of nowhere, but increasing resistance from Jews in Poland had made Himmler very angry. The prisoners at Treblinka had set it on fire. The ghettos were in an uproar of revolution. Over 300 Jews escaped from Sobibor. Axion Reinhardt is drawing to the end, and Himmler wants every Jew in Poland dead. Eventually, Janina is allowed back in. The remaining non-Jewish prisoners at Majdanek were obviously ghosts of their former selves. They had been sure they were next, but it doesn't seem like they are about to be murdered imminently. And Janina goes back to work.
Wow.
It's incredible to me to think about what she's going through here. She is Jewish, and she is coping with the knowledge of what just happened here. Without being able to reveal any sort of a personal connection. And still carrying on the work to help the people that she can help. She would not give up. No matter the horrors, no matter the stakes, no matter the circumstances, nothing could stop her. She was relentless and she would keep going until the bitter end.
Later in the book, she's actually organizing a plot for a rescue of Majdanek prisoners that was totally crazy. And if it had been discovered, she would have been immediately arrested, tortured, and murdered. And if it had succeeded, she would have been immediately arrested, tortured, and murdered. But she risked that every time she walked into Majdanek. But there were also times when she said, oh, I really want to do this, but I don't trust that person. It's not worth the risk.
There were times when she almost overplayed her hand. Maybe I've gone too far this time.
And in this way, she shows us that she was a human, right? She was risking her life. And in many ways, she succeeded because she was able to, you know, negotiate for the relief of around 10,000 Poles. And she helped countless others through her relief work. But she didn't see everything as a success. Some of the things that she did, such as being able to get the release of over 2,000 out of 3,600 Polish peasants from Majdanek, she did not view that as a success because she couldn't save everyone. There were limits to what she could realistically achieve.
She did recognize that she did accomplish important things, but at the same time, she was always haunted by the thought that more could have been done. Then at the end of the war, when the Soviets took over Poland and installed a communist government, it was still too dangerous for her to reveal her true identity. So she became Dr. Janina Sukodolska, social worker.
And is quickly made the deputy director of Poland's National Social Welfare Organization.
Ah!
She's not a social worker. She has no experience, other than, of course, all of the experience during the war.
Right.
But for the next 10 years, she will provide vital care to millions of Poles. She saves lives. She improves lives. She works with the same level of relentlessness as she did during the war, still hiding who she really is until she can get out. And we still don't know how she got out. Some people in the U.S. managed to get her husband Henry a fellowship that will allow him to go to Canada. And then, hopefully, quickly bring her over. He emigrates to Canada, and the system falls apart. And she is stuck in Poland for years, in increasing danger if she is found out. Finally, Henry can't stand it anymore, and he announces he's coming back to be with her. He won't leave her there anymore.
Aww.
She is horrified. Do not do that. It's so dangerous. Do not come back. But she knows he will. And somehow, she magically gets herself to East Germany, gets herself a visa, and gets herself to Toronto. And we still have no idea how she made that happen.
Huh.
It was impossible, but if Henry was going to risk his life coming back, she was not going to allow that to happen. And whatever risk she took to do it, she got out.
Wow.
They eventually moved to the U.S., and Janina becomes a tenured math professor at Illinois Institute of Technology.
Dang!
Where she works the rest of her career as a brilliant math professor.
Wow.
Renaming herself again, Janina Melberg. So, back to Melberg, but keeping a bit of the Countess with her. She will be Janina for the rest of her life. And lives her entire life without breathing a word of any of this. Presumably, maybe her closest friends know, but no one else knows who she was, what she has done. And Perry and Joanna think that she probably only wrote this memoir when she did, because in the late 1960s, there was an uprising of anti-Semitism in Poland and rising across Europe, and a specific kind of anti-Semitic narrative going on that the Jewish victims of the Holocaust had no gumption or self-determination. They showed no resistance and had to be rescued by others. Janina was infuriated by that narrative and also incredibly concerned. She knew how dangerous that line of thinking was. She had seen it play out in real life. She had been a resistor. She had been the rescuer. She couldn't help Jews, but she helped who she could help. she was a Jew who had rescued non-Jews from the Holocaust, which was a story no one was telling, and she felt it was important to tell.
Between us, Joanna and I have read thousands of statements, testimonies, accounts, memoirs, diaries of Holocaust survivors. There are lots of stories of rescue from World War II, and there's not a single one like this about a Jew who rescued non-Jews. But just from the wartime documentation, we found that Yanina negotiated the release from German captivity of almost 10,000 Poles. And that doesn't even include the number of Poles, particularly the prisoners at Majdanek, who survived because of the aid that she and her co-workers were able to provide. The numbers are staggering.
This is a completely different story than any Holocaust story we've ever heard before. It was agony trying to figure out what to talk about in this episode because there's 400,000 other unbelievable, remarkable things that she did. So many incredible stories. It's been a remarkable month for me working on this. Everyone has to read this book. It has shifted the way that I think about World War II, about the Holocaust, about all of these stories that have been sort of neatly wrapped up in a very specific package for us. This is how we think about these things. This is the story.
What's the name of the book again?
The Counterfeit Countess, the Jewish woman who rescued thousands of Poles during the Holocaust.
Cool.
The effect of her life is, math joke, incalculable. We cannot know how many people she saved.
Mm.
And yet, no one has ever heard her name. No one has ever heard this story.
In a way, that gives me so much hope, which is so appropriate. To think of how many stories like hers.
Yeah, how many more.
Finding stories like hers confirms my belief that there's so many good people out there doing so many things like that without the praise or the attention.
Yeah.
She gave those people hope then, and she's given us hope now that there are Yanina Melbergs out there everywhere just doing it.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Huge thanks to our guests, Barry White and Joanna Sliva. You can find more information, including resources, pictures, links, and more on our website at whatshernamepodcast.com. There you can also find links to the book, Counterfeit Countess.
You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, where we post lots of photos each week.
Music for this episode was provided by Tria Logo, Amanda Setlick-Wilson, Michael Levy, Adam Aston, Nico DiNapoli, Esther Abrami, and Kevin McLeod.
Our theme song was composed and performed by Daniel Foster Smith.
Our intern is Katie Boucher.
What's Her Name is produced by Olivia Mickle and Katie Nelson, and this episode was edited by Olivia Mickle.